suffering must be reflected upon. Therefore, when you think about suffering, there is all the different varieties of experiences, painful experiences, adverse circumstances that are suffering. Birth, old age, sickness, and death is suffering. Not obtaining happiness is suffering. Constant search for obtaining happiness is suffering itself, deals with a lot of suffering. Encountering painful experiences is suffering. The whole lifelong search for a situation without suffering, free of suffering, is suffering itself. So the pursuit of every action that is instigated with the motivation to achieving happiness has tremendous possibilities of suffering. So there is the immediate experiences of encountering adversities that are suffering. There are, in the midst of whatever experiences, diverse kinds of experiences that we may be experiencing, which has also a fuller potential of future arousing of adversities, which are also greater sufferings. So there are all these kinds of suffering. But fundamentally, three things. Whenever we know, whenever we do not see the causes that are rampantly created, particularly causes that come from the seed of afflictions, to be suffering, that is one suffering. That is the first kind of suffering. Suffering caused by abject ignorance of not knowing negative causes that we create in pursuit of happiness, particularly. That's one suffering. Second, not knowing change, not being able to accept change, not being able to mold in accordance with the constant change and impermanence that is the law of nature, is suffering. Then the third is not knowing the selflessness of phenomena, not knowing the selflessness of self, is also suffering. So when we say ignorance is the cause of suffering, one is calling this ignorance of not knowing selflessness, ignorance of not knowing or seeing change, and ignorance of not knowing the power of afflictions and the causes that it creates in the experience of suffering or pain, adversities. So these three things are suffering. So when we look at it, therefore, the Buddhist teachings say there is no sentient being who is not suffering. So sometimes when we think, oh, I'm not particularly suffering at this moment, what one is not being aware of are all the subtle features of suffering. So one is associating suffering only with very big, impactful experiences and not the subtle ignorance of change, ignorance of selflessness, ignorance of the tremendous amount of afflictions that we continually create that lead into future experiences of suffering. So not knowing these three aspects, not knowing anatman in Sanskrit, anatman, A-N-A-T-M-A-N, anatman, no self or selfless nature. Not knowing dukkha, D-U-K-H-A, which is then suffering. Then not knowing parivartan, change, P-A-R-I-V-A-R-T-A-N. Therefore, being sort of not seeing transitoriness, not seeing change or transformation. Therefore, this then are the basis of suffering. Then grasping. What is grasping? Grasping is like a very simple analogy, always can be used, is a person who does not know how to swim, thrown into the water, grabs the water, fully knowing you can't hold on to water, But nevertheless, the kind of natural habit that the person has is to immediately hold on to something, fully aware you cannot hold, but still not being able to sort of overcome the habit of trying to hold on even to that what you know intellectually you cannot hold. That is the kind of action or a kind of a reflex action that we have, impulse that we have, which is grasping. So where does such a grasping come from? Seems to be some message in our mind that says some things, if you grasp tightly, are holdable, that you can still hold on to it. That you could probably reverse the law of nature by even making water solid, for example. That baseless hope that we have, isn't it? That's grasping. So where does that grasping come from? Grasping comes from some notion that you can hold on to it. So it's a mixed feeling where your logical mind may say it won't help you. No matter how much you hold on to it, try to grab on to it, it cannot be grasped. But you cannot simultaneously still resist the temptation to hold on to it. So therefore, when you look at it in that way, where does grasping seem to come from is sort of an impulse, very strong impulse. So what is the basis of such an impulse? It must come from something. The grasping is the consequent state. It's the consequence. It's the resultant state. Grasping. Grasping is a full-fledged expressed motion, action. But the action has to come from an idea. Where does that idea come from that influences the action of grasping? Fundamental ignorance. What could that be? What do we mean by fundamental ignorance? Let's start from the beginning. Ignorance. What is ignorance? Is ignorance one ignorance? It's a combination. What is it a combination of? Not seeing things clearly is ignorance. Yes. So another word would be not aware of the true nature is ignorance. So there is not one singular ignorance. One is talking about each concept, each perception, each feeling, each form that we encounter, formations of every aggregates, wherever and whenever the true nature is not seen, then that is then not knowing, and that not knowing is probably, as a human term we use, ignorant of. So ignorant of, not knowing the true nature, subsequently everything that we conclude being only partially accurate tends to be then founded upon the basis of partiality. So independently, not knowing is not capable of doing much damage. But the not knowing, when it becomes partial, when it becomes biased, that is what then triggers the problem. It's like an electric switch. If the electric switch is kept as it is, it has the potency of illuminating a dark room, but until someone flicks it on, the lights do not come. So triggering is the PowerPoint. So what triggers the ignorance into becoming problematic, and why problematic is, it propels the motion of causes. There is immediate causes and there is dormant causes. Immediate causes are whatever reaction you have. Dormant causes are sort of lie passive for future regeneration when it meets with other causes and conditions. But here we are looking at the one that propels, that triggers the causes. What triggers the causes is the bias. So we have now not knowing the true nature. When that then unifies with the bias, it immediately triggers the second nidana, which is likes, dislikes, and the indifference. That's the bias. That's the triggering of the non-awareness. So shamatha meditation, or all of the mindfulness meditation. Now, if you have a question, how does the mindfulness meditation and the 12 nidanas go together? Now, that's of the third thing. Besides the relationship and the connection, then you try to find the connection between the practices. What's the relationship between Four Noble Truths and the five, for this? What's the relationship between 12 nidanas and four mindfulnesses? What's the relationship between prostrations and, you know, the five, the four this or the five this and whatever it is? You try to, you know, they're not uncles and aunts and cousins. You don't have to all categorize them into a particular relationship. That's also one of the habits I find very predominant. Every relationship that you need to find is found in the Four Noble Truths. That's all there is. Every practice. Therefore, the basis being the Four Noble Truths, therefore, all practices are given. So that's just a different topic, but I wanted to insert it here. Now, however, here when we are talking in connection to what we spoke about yesterday afternoon, mindfulness meditation, cultivating such a meditation, which is the method, allows one to address this habit of bias, habit of giving wheels to the non-awareness, not awareness. So the birthing process of everything is set into motion by that impulse that there has to be some bias or a decision or an idea that has to be expressed to a state that doesn't realize that it has moved away from whatever the true nature is to make your own storyline. So ignorance to karmic formation is just a simple way of not only not knowing the true nature, but we call it ignorance. But ignorance is not distinct from arrogance. So you have to come up with some reason to make sure that your not knowing the true nature is valid. So it's almost like similar to when you meet with teachers. Sometimes I suddenly bump into someone, and if you see me from a far away distance, then it seems to be quite all right because there's a certain amount of preparedness. Then if you have that what is called, you know, in a personal audience or a personal interview, then you write letters, Barbara tells you when to come, the Vajra brings you there. So you have, then you sit in the basement for some time and you collect your thoughts so you can articulate them quite properly. Now there are moments when suddenly we meet. Not everybody, but most often times, then the people say the strangest of things. Oh, you have no hair today. Or, oh, you're attending the annual retreat. So, you know, you have to say something. And even while having said, you know, that's this not necessary to say in the first place. A hello will do, good morning will do. But you have to somehow validate that moment of encounter. So it's quite like this. So the biases just pour out of us because you have to somehow make sure that why you have ignored the true nature has to be validated. That's called arrogance. So arrogance is not so, of course, there's the abject arrogance, the pride, to be very proud, to have the ego, yes. But the ego, subtle ego, is just that you have to make sure that whatever mistakes you have done is convincing to others, to yourself. Of course, in the process of convincing the others, the one who becomes most convinced about the lie is one's own self. So self-deception comes. So that's called delusion. That's called self-deception. That is the arrogance. That is the ego. And so you're grasping to it out of necessity. Somehow you have to sustain and have a sort of a reason that's convincing enough to have ignored. But then the very enticing and the sort of seductive quality of that mistake or ignorance or the arrogance is that it is entertaining. So ignorance, while it is arrogance, the second aspect of ignorance is that it is also busy. It feeds upon friction. It grows upon friction. So wherever there is some movement, the movement makes what you have believed yourself to be necessary or the reasoning that you give to have ignored the true nature to becoming more active, more busy. And the movement of it makes whatever you are doing, the ignorance that you have projected, to becoming more solid. So it is in the same way we can see in our own selves. Whenever we are nervous, we fidget more. You do strange things. So it is in the same way. Wherever there is a certain amount of nervousness of a mistake, you will find yourself trying to balance that state of mistake by keeping yourself preoccupied with a movement. Therefore, in meditation, non-grasping, stillness, silence, single-pointed concentration are always encouraged, is to go into defeating or being able to free yourself from those very subtle, however very personal, intimate experiences that altogether combine to bringing about what we so easily call ignorance, but is actually so subtle, so easy to get into, very seductive in nature, very enticing in nature, that ultimately what you come up with is this inane sort of an expression. I like it, I don't like it. You're indifferent towards it. And so when that happens, it immediately begins to become more impactful. So now here, according to what Dean Baker has been saying, so grasping, coming from ignorance, but have a correct understanding of what ignorance is. Ignorance is, as we always say, the most insecure aspect. It is insecure because the primordially, it's sort of, we say the primordial wisdom. What does primordial wisdom mean? Is part of your awareness that knows that you've sort of moved away. The axis of your balance in seeing phenomena as what it truly is has been sort of, again, bent towards a much more heavier concept. You've built something, so you've moved away. Therefore, that sense of ignorance that you have succumbed to, immediately recognizing as a meditator within one's own self, grasping primarily comes from the notion of something being more than the real nature, and where that is immediately joined together with an expression of bias. Then you've expressed something. So that is the idea being designed, as we say. So when the idea of the bias reaches a table where the designing of it takes place. Now, what does that mean? Yesterday we spoke about it. Dean Baker. So yesterday we spoke about consciousness, for example, as the designer. And so in that regard, we did talk about causal consciousness and resultant consciousness. So when the bias, karmic formation is liking something, disliking something, it triggers, as I said, triggers the non-awareness of the true nature. So non-awareness is propelled into some bias, some partiality, some kind of a discriminating opinion of likes, dislikes, or indifference. So when likes, dislikes, and indifference subtly is understood, what does it impact is, it impacts. Where does the bias grow? Is the mind. This is the level of consciousness. Isn't it? So consciousness, what did you understand it as being? Just as we say, is there one ignorance? No. Likewise, is there one consciousness? And the answer is no. So then what is consciousness? The English word consciousness, if it does have a more connotation of there being something, like a soul, then even in the word, using the word mind, if you fixate on what the term itself means, it can be very misleading. Therefore, we begin the question by, is it one? It is not one. It is not one because in accordance to the five aggregates, the fifth aggregate, consciousness, one refers to it as the sense consciousnesses. There is the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, the awareness of the eye, the capability of the ears to hear, the capability of the nose to smell, the capability of the tongue to taste, the capability of the body to feel, and the capacity of the mind, the capability of the mind to think, feel, have sensation, are all called consciousnesses. Like the five fingers and then the palm, you have the five sense consciousness and you have the mind consciousness as the base. But in the same way that the design goes, the mind consciousness is also has a gross mind consciousness and a subtle mind consciousness. Gross mind consciousnesses are usually at the level of thoughts, mental formations, mental activities. Now everyone here who has studied Buddhism know about eight kinds of consciousnesses, according to the, especially the Chittamatran perspective, we talk about eight. But here we are not going into that. Let's just talk about it, keeping it simple as subtle and gross mind consciousness. Gross mind consciousness is the mind that you all talk about all the time. Whenever you all talk about mind, primarily you're talking about a gross mind. It's not findable. You cannot find it. So mind's nature is empty. Gross mind's nature is empty. This is easy to understand for anyone. Even if you are a new Buddhist, one of the activities we could have is go and find your mind. So, some people may say, but I came to find my mind. Came to the wrong place because you are not going to find mind. No matter where you look, how you look, for a very easy way perspective, we do find mind is generally a supposition that we have, that we give a name to. Very, very able, you know, its ability cannot be denied. It's very, very skilled, it's very, very awake, it's very, very sharp. But it doesn't have a form. It doesn't have a structure. So beginners on the path of meditation must always know that somehow here we try to keep a balance of knowing. It is not locatable. It is not findable. You cannot find it, see it. But at the same time, you know that it has a lot of power. It has a lot of potential, a lot of capability. However, gross mind is where you take that same capability to being sort of intermixed with emotions. So when you say, I have feelings, I have emotions, I sense, then your sense consciousnesses are becoming so biased that the mind becomes more dull, creating its grosser aspect. So the gross mind is usually a mind that is intertwined in personal experiences. So that's why in the teachings of the aggregate, there are clearly two defined aspects. consciousness and the mental formation left pretty much without triggering the bias is awareness. As soon as the bias is triggered, you're not only satisfied with having not seen the true nature, but that you have to bring in the arrogance of asserting your point, defending your ignorance. That makes the propelling of the bias, that makes the sort of projecting of the biases that come out. And so where that bias is produced, then immediately one sinks into a sense of personalizing that experience. So you like it, it's your personal experience. You dislike it, it's your personal experience. You are indifferent towards it, it's your personal experience. So the personalizing of it makes having moved away from the true nature even more prominent, even more defined. So that is, therefore, in that regard, we say, sense consciousnesses and the mind becomes very wrapped in the personal experience. That makes the grossness of the mind. So when sense consciousnesses, your hearing, your seeing, your tasting, your feeling, and your thinking, all of these are tamed to settle without too much of a projection of bias and opinions, then it allows the gross mind to have more spaciousness, more calmness, more clarity, to be free from the trappings of personal experience, to making, so to speak, the cloud move away to reveal the blueness of the sky. So therefore, mindfulness meditation allows the single-pointed concentration to be there, so that the concentration of it reduces the sort of hunger for personal experience of the sense consciousnesses, allowing the gross mind to be able to be free, freer from responding to personal expectations. That clarity itself then reveals the subtle mind. So gross mind and subtle mind are not two different things. Gross mind is heavily preoccupied. When the preoccupation itself is a little bit settled, it's like when you are very preoccupied, you can't make the right decisions. Whenever you take a break and you settle your mind and you have a little bit more time and space, you can make a clearer judgment. It is in the same way. It's the same mind. But since it is a little bit freed from the preoccupations of personalizing everything, subtle mind becomes more aware. Now, when the subtle mind, now in our case, what do you think is more strong, subtle mind or gross mind? We are all going to be humble today and say gross mind. So in some of your case, maybe you're fully manifesting subtle mind all the time. I don't know. My case, gross mind, of course. It's heavily burdened with personalizing everything. So if I die today, then I die with a gross mind. That gross mind is fully conditioned with the resultant karma. Causes. You know, I haven't been idle my whole life. Done many things. Everything that I have done has not only been expressed as a karma, as a cause that has been created, but I've learned a great deal from it. Repetitions of how many times do you think one is selfish in one lifetime? Expression of selfishness? But each time you have been selfish, you have also recognized it. So there's a recognition of it. Each recognition confirms familiarity, solidifies familiarity. So that very powerful familiarity is the resultant consciousness. It stays. It stays as a very familiar sort of a impulse and impact that is created. And so it begins to immediately create the blueprint, the structure in your own sphere of awareness. So that as one creates more causes, externally as you express more causes, the more similar kind of a information is stored. That information is not necessarily you did this, he did that, she did this, and that happened 2 years ago, and that happened 4 years ago. If you think information stored is that way, then that's not the kind of information. At the very subtle consciousness's base where the seed of the karma is created, the impact of the karma is created, there's only one information that is being stored, actually. Because everything that we do, good things and bad things, everything we say, good and bad, everything we think, good and bad, comes down into only one information. In English, it could be simply the letter is. It's a sense of a rhythmic information that says it is, it is. Yes, 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 it is. It sort of, it affirms. It's an affirming sort of a message that goes there. What it affirms is it's fine to have moved away. That there is valid reasoning of really retaining the familiar habits. So ultimately, what we are taking refuge into is the refuge in the belief that there is. And what it is that we are believing in is that there is a mountain, there is a tree, there are people, there are good people, there are wonderful people, there are Buddhist people. I am here, you are, you know, that's what we are doing constantly. The information that is coming is that yes, things are divisible. Things are form-oriented. Things are there, objects to be gotten, objects to be discarded, beliefs to be had, philosophies to be studied. Imagine a book you read. From the first line to the last line, just affirming the belief, there is once upon a time, there was a king, there is a queen, there are the subjects, there are the heroes, there are the villains, there are the heroines, they have to be, there have been a mistake. The mistake has to be justified or not justified. The negative ones have to be punished. The positive ones end up victorious. And the end. They're again the same thing. There is that land. There is this ocean. There is this. There is me. There is there. This is ours. That is mine. The territories. The distinctions. Everything. So we subject our minds to the information that yes, it's very fine to know things are there, different from you, you are here, they are there, this is yours, that is theirs. And so when the is, yes, it is there, it is there, it is there, that information is continuously fed. And whenever sort of one is trying to counteract that, yes, of course, it becomes very threatening. You're not going to easily waste thousands of lifetimes' effort so very easily. If for 100 lifetimes, from a Buddhistic perspective, you've tried to retain a firm belief that a mountain is a mountain and nothing else, after 100 lifetimes of having said that, suddenly if somebody has to say, oh, that's not true, you really don't want to lose all that effort without gaining anything from it. Look at our normal practices, normal occurrences in the day. If you've worked hard in the kitchen the whole day, and then at the end of the day, nobody comes to eat, then you get very frustrated because you worked so hard, and now there's nobody. So it is in the same way, is that when the mind begins to tell itself, well, you know, things may not be as they truly are, it's a very hard thing to take because it sets us into a point where we think, well, it then all that effort has been wasted for no reason. What was I holding on to? What was I grasping to? What was I solidifying? And so when that, and we encountered that, then it becomes the fear of emptiness. In Mahayana, therefore, one talks about not teaching the truth of emptiness prematurely because people become afraid. It is said in the case of the transmitting the second world turning of the wheel of Dharma that when Buddha propounded the teaching of the emptiness, that there were hundreds of beings who fainted. And it is true. we today are very much more better equipped than those who fainted during the second turning of the wheel of Dharma. We disappear. We think emptiness is just too extremely difficult. I'm not going to listen to it. We shut our ears. Why does that happen? Is because it's a big blow to our, you know, whatever we have maintained. We've held on so tightly for so long, and suddenly we see that it was really not necessary. It really is not the case. That's very frightening to us. So therefore, even in meditation, we often encounter such moments where we may not want to face the true nature of reality. So that's how religiosity of Buddhism begins to happen. We'd rather faithfully do things rather than allow what we do to transform our mind to such a point that it begins to see things clearly as they truly are. But when we succumb to that kind of an obstruction, then, of course, something good out of your association with the different kinds of theistic approach to the practices may come about. But causes are not completely exhausted. The mother, the seed of affirming ignorance is not exhausted. And like any root root problem that is sustained, then no matter how much treatment is given, problem is not eliminated. The problem is always there. As long as the problem is always there, no matter how much the aggregates of body changes, feeling changes, you might die and you may be reborn again in any kind of a life form, the firm belief that it is there will always be enough ground basis for the continuity of all causes to be there. So if one dies and one is born, let's say, as a mouse. Now in that being also, the same seed of firm belief that separation of self and others is there is enough. Firm belief that there is an object to whom you can have likes, you can have dislikes, and you can be indifferent, is there. To a mice, no matter how small the being may be, there is immense projection of that sort of bias or opinion. And the basis of that is it firmly confirms to itself that you are you, other is other, and you derive something from the other, and I experience. Your own personal experience is very valid. So long as the personal experience is very valid, the expression of how you do that may be very different from your previous lifetime as a human being, but nevertheless is very common. Commonness is in knowing a lot of expressions without, you know, the mice having to then recall a memory and say, oh, the humanly, how do I remember how to emote? There's no need to do that. Does a mouse have to remember its previous birth as a human being to project 5 primary afflictions? It doesn't have to. Just the basis of its consciousness, having had enough information of positing the self as distinct from the other, is basis enough for it to be very familiar with the karmic formation of liking things and going towards it, disliking things, running away from it, and an indifference of closing its eyes and going to sleep. And then it's a full life form. We have 84,000 emotions. A mouse, I don't know, let's say 1,200. Just a number that I came up with. So if you think that's too many, 54, let's say. But it is still strong enough to keep on adding to the basic information that, yes, the expression of liking is fine. You have to do it. Expression of disliking is fine. You have to do it. So the mice dies. And then the aggregates, physical aggregates of the mice, are completely decomposed. It is destroyed. It is gone. But when the causes and conditions lead it to again being born as a human being. In that state, then, sort of causes and conditions leading to its net birth, birth, the very conception level of it, is simply in that there is an assertion, self. And based upon self, immediately you're very familiar. The rebounding of the information of personal experience of the self, expressed as likes, dislikes, and indifference, again catches up. And then depending upon how acute and complex and sophisticated your senses are, and in the case of human beings, we have a very sophisticated sixth sense. And therefore, the sophisticated sixth sense makes the sort of information gathering of the assertion of the self even more complex. And therefore, again, it keeps on building to it. So the cyclic existence is unending, is in that the assertion of the self continues in whatever forms it may be. From a very singular sort of a single cell being to a complex being such as human beings, it continuously is there. Now, however, such a cause is in constant connection with all other causes. There is the father's cause, there is the mother's cause, siblings' causes. You know, even in one family, if you have a father, mother, and a child, you have three individuals, past causes, creating causes, combined causes, individual causes. And so when all causes meet with one another, then it becomes causes supported by conditions, different conditions. And so when all the different diverse kinds of causes and conditions come together, then there is the manifesting of all kinds of situations. These keep us preoccupied. The preoccupation with all the causes and conditions, trying to make sense of all what we encounter, however, goes very well with the distraction, because it continuously makes us feel very alive, very worthy. And the ego's self-worth comes from, as I said earlier, activity, from being busy, from being preoccupied, that doesn't so much preoccupied that it doesn't address the need to actually know the true nature. And so in the context of the Nidanas, we talk about consciousness. In the context of the aggregates, yesterday we talked about the same, consciousness. In the context of explaining aggregates, one talks about consciousness in the form of what its activities are. So there are the five consciousnesses, sense consciousnesses, gross consciousness, subtle consciousness. Same is the one that we talk about in the three Nidanas, in the third Nidana, consciousness. But the take that one takes in referring to the third Nidana, consciousness, is more as the sphere where all information is stored, where it has the input of the information and the output of all the causes that are being generated. So it's a juncture from both the aspects. So the juncture being the very important, that also is then referred to as recognizing how to tame one's consciousnesses, sense consciousnesses, so that it goes deeper into understanding more the subtle consciousness, the subtle mind. If one is able to reach the subtle mind, then it enables oneself to discern between a lot of unnecessary things that could be eliminated, so that the aggregates themselves, the aggregate consciousness, has the support of clarity rather than being submerged in personal experiences. So that then has to be sort of understood. Where consciousness itself, the sphere from where you are holding all the information, itself is not cleaned. It's not cleaned in the sense that you eliminate what is false concept and you allow it to remain in its most natural essence. If that itself is not done, then, as I've been repeatedly saying, the emotionality, even in the practice, becomes sort of hijacked hijacks the meaning and the essence of the Dharma. So compassion, rather than it being clear awareness of things as they are, and the genuine compassion arising from it, becomes emotional compassion. So when you sort of think about the sufferings of all the sentient beings, and then sort of break down in tears, then it's very good. It's very nice. It's very kindness. There's no arguing the fact that you have a very sensitive mind. Does it do any good to anyone? No. It doesn't do good to anyone. How can it do good to anyone when you're so preoccupied with your own self? In the same way, when one is practicing patience, if there is genuine sense of embracing things as they arise, that which comes out from knowing true nature of things as they are, then that is real kind of patience. But otherwise, no matter how patient you are, it's a selfish patience. You're always going to be very much sort of expecting things to turn out your way. So it's a very covert, kind of a selfish planning, that patience, that kind of patience. So it gets exhausted at some point, and then the explosion is just terrible after that. My patience with you has run out, people say that. So your patience runs out when the true nature is not understood. Therefore, realizing Dhamma means knowing the true nature of things. What is the true nature of things? Then, true nature of things cannot be again posited, which again is the mistaken way of working with things. You cannot posit true nature. Other words is, you cannot posit emptiness nature of aggregates. Just as ignorance is not one, consciousness is not one. In the same way, seeing emptiness also correctly becomes important. If you see emptiness as one that you impose upon everything, then that is negation. When you negate something, then you are saying aggregates do not exist, which is not what Mahayana is teaching. When Mahayana says, realize the true nature of phenomena, outer phenomena, inner phenomena, it is asking you to drop what it is not. And being able to see what is not, you'll have to then go into your own interpretations. Because whatever is not the true nature hasn't been piled on by somebody else. It's primarily mind's own supposition, one's own supposition of what it is. So when we, however, look at it, we find a lot of things that we have sustained, therefore, particularly our emotions, anger, jealousy, desire, ignorance, arrogance, all of these basically are sustained without there being a basis. These cannot be found as a basis. They cannot be found to be originating from somewhere. They cannot be found as an independent feeling or an emotion or a concept. But there are many subtle and gross levels of what could be nothing but suppositions. We suppose them to be. We think it is. It remains unchallenged. And therefore, not knowing the true nature of the inner phenomena, not knowing the true nature of your emotions, not knowing the true nature of your thoughts, not knowing the true nature of your feelings, only trusting levels of different kinds of assumptions. We think it is there, we suppose it is there, we're not really sure what it is, but we think at some point it is there. So there are all these guesses that we keep. And the guesses sustain a kind of a make-believe concept, which is not true, but we sustain it nevertheless. And we try to sustain it by all different kinds of, you know, supportive actions that we create to it. And so we sustain that, but the sustenance of that continually feeds into your liking becoming more and more demanding, your disliking becoming more and more demanding, And therefore, as the selfishness increases, affliction, negative afflictions become more increased. As the anger of yourself is more and more sustained, it becomes more gross, more heavy, more demanding, then immediately it again creates stronger and stronger displeasure in many things. And so the self becomes bloated, self becomes bigger and bigger, more and more created, more and more believable. And the nurturing ingredients for that self, the arrogance of the self, the ego of the belief of the self, is nourished because you allow all the other things that sustain it to be there. The assumption of aggression, the assumption that jealousy is needed, the assumption that, you know, all of the afflictions, negative afflictions are needed. So it goes back and forth helping one another in creating a deluded concept. It is nothing but delusion. So the delusion, sort of the aspect of all the concepts that we have, is nothing is really seen for what it truly is. Emotions are not seen as what it truly is. But rather we think somewhere, somehow it is sufficient to have a vague idea of what it is, and to take the vague idea to becoming so important that it becomes just our personality, it becomes our nature. And that personality, that nature, becomes the basis of every action that we create for the others. So we don't necessarily mean to have enemies. But when it comes to self and happiness, and the assumption that this is needs to be catered to, this needs to be sustained, we don't mind projecting anger, creating enemies. So it is in the same case of the outer phenomena. In this case, the outer phenomena predominantly is the other, what we sometimes think is responsible for whatever it is that we are feeling. So as a meditator, the important factor becomes is to really see the separation, the distinction between all of one's own suppositions, what it is, have a clear understanding of that. And then when one sees how many of the things are the suppositions of the mind, then we may be able to look at the other side and see what is not a supposition, but maybe the true nature. So mindfulness meditation, looking at body and being observant, looking at feeling and letting feelings be, looking at mind, whatever it comes up, letting it be. Looking at phenomena, whether it is elements, whether it is senses, whatever arises, letting it be. When you train the mind to be mindful, and the mindfulness then sort of brings about concentration, sense of concentrated awareness, which is not seduced by your own interpretations of suppositions, your own suppositions and assumptions. But there is a sense of letting be your suppositions and being very matter-of-fact focused upon whatever the body is, whatever the mind is, whatever the feeling is, whatever the phenomena is. Then you come to a point where you are able to clearly come and see what is called, what is not a supposition. And so, what are suppositions? What are not suppositions? To that question, we come to when we really are observant, when the mindfulness and the concentration is really clear, then we find there's hardly anything that this busy mind of ours can actually come up with that is not a supposition. Look in your own mind and see the unceasing continuum of thoughts. Basically, they're all suppositions, assuming something there, something not there, like this, like that, up, down, so on and so forth. So that's why in the Madhyamika teachings, one takes a long stick, one takes a short stick. We've gone through that in the Kshetra, isn't it? So this is long, this is short. Then you take the short one and take a shorter one, and then the short one becomes the long one, and then there's another short one. And so then you take the very short one that you've taken and you take another shorter one, then this becomes long, this becomes short. So we begin to see what we have done is we've lived a very busy, preoccupied mind that basically has to make do with hurried opinions and hurried suppositions. But there is no depth. There is no real basis of having the time to consider something that is as it is, rather than sort of the busyness of trying to constantly create all these suppositions. And so when in training of resting the mind in stillness is developed in a meditator, stillness settles the sense of suppositions or the greed with which we need to constantly suppose many things. The body as it remains reveals what its own true nature. It is a body, nothing beyond that. Feelings are feelings, nothing beyond that. When there is a stillness as it comes, it settles the mind into becoming more aware of the body as body, feeling as feeling, mind as mind, perceptions as phenomena as phenomena, and then letting be all the other sort of guesses and the presumptions that one has to continuously be sort of preoccupied with, creates a sense of then what we call genuine friendship, genuine flexible attitude. So state of equanimity. Now, from the four foundations of mindfulness or any kind of meditation, the resultant state is equanimity. Samadhi, concentration, equanimity. Three things that are parallel, that are the same. But the equanimity here is a mind that is balanced. Balanced in that it doesn't tip towards suppositions and assumptions. But it is a balanced mind. It is balanced because it does not become sort of kidnapped by the likes, dislikes, and the indifference. It's not propelled. It is not triggered into an action. It's able to remain. In that remaining, there is the sort of disintegration of all the layers of busyness, of concepts that we have created. So it's almost like an unpeeling. If you look at, let's say, any kind of a skin of a plantain tree, where the leaf plantain tree is made up of many leaves that look like a trunk, but where the leaf, outer leaf, doesn't reach, have any nourishment, it dries up, shrivels, it falls down. Then the second level, again, doesn't get the water, it dies down. So if it is dried without the water, then all the leaves simply fall apart. In the same way, where there is the stillness of the mind that is not constantly distracted by your own preferences, the habitual pattern of liking and disliking, where the personal experience is eliminated by remaining mindful, then all the suppositions that we have, like a plantain leaf, dies, doesn't have the nourishment, it falls apart. When it falls apart, then what arises is then said to be the natural nature of emptiness. Now, it is called emptiness. But again, emptiness is not the disappearance of things. So many people, I think, make the mistake of thinking emptiness is then there is no aggregate, there is no form, there is no feeling, there is no formation. There is no consciousness. There is form. There is feeling. There is perception. There is formation. There is consciousness. But that form is freed from duality. It's freed from your personal likes and dislikes. Feelings are also there. But the feelings are not wrapped in personal ownership. Perceptions are also there. But the personal thing is eliminated from there. That's sort of put to rest. So emptiness is a much more embracing, much more friendlier way of being able to appreciate everything in its truer form. forms in its truer nature, being able to go more to the very root basis from where everything originates. So, therefore, even in the greatest of the, or the highest of the Mao Mudra and Dzogchen teachings, usually there is one where the first statement of enlightenment is nothing happens. So that has to be understood. Nothing does happen. You're not going to go somewhere. You're not going to disappear. You're not going to sort of have aggregates disappear. You're not going to be someone suddenly so enlightened that you have no more feelings, perceptions, like a zombie. That would be very unfortunate. You will be you. Place will be the same. Time will be the same. The whole number of beings around you will be the same. But at the same time, the difference will happen. Is that the relationship to yourself will be different. Relationship to others will be different. Relationship to how you perceive things will be different. When you look at aggregates, there is no agenda of gain and loss. When you have feelings, there is no agenda of gain and loss. When there is no agenda of your own gain and the sort of resisting to any kind of loss, apprehension of a loss, then wherever you are, it's a peaceful state. It's a harmonious state. It is a state that is perfect, excellent as it is. And so, primarily, the study of really working with your own self, the study of the Dhamma, practicing the Dhamma, trying to know the true nature, allows a much more easier relationship, healthier, far more simple relationship between the self and the others. What makes this samsara is the brittleness of the relationship. It's very brittle, it's very fragile, because it's completely founded upon the personal take of what you perceive. Now, when seeing things in its own true nature, self and the notion of self being so much a supposition, others and seeing others with all the different kinds of opinions that we have of the others, being also a mental supposition. So if everything seems, whatever distinctions that we make, differences that we make, discriminations that we bring, are mainly founded upon supposition of the mind, then such an understanding would allow us to have a much more sense of unbiased attitude. So the unbiased attitude is equanimity. Equanimity, if it is on the training ground, is meditation. But an equanimity that is much more the view, that there is no separation between meditation and post-meditation. So when the knowing the true nature of self and the phenomena, the inner phenomena, outer phenomena, arises, when you are able to see how causes and conditions create all the experiences, it is an unfolding experience. However, one learns to take this assertion of the self and the tremendous attraction of the individual experience out of the picture. If you sort of rest yourself a little bit by not allowing to fall back into the habitual pattern of asserting the self's individual experience constantly and everything as it arises, then there is a much more sense of calmness. That calmness has no room for the bias. Where bias is not there, where the liking, disliking, indifferent attitude, that bias is not there, then there is harmony. So in that state of concentration, in that state of unbiased equanimity, one is able to find tremendous harmony. Then there is no need to go anywhere to find a state of enlightenment. There is no perfection to be searched anywhere. Everything here is perfect. What makes us imperfect is the agenda of the self. So, therefore, enlightenment is not very difficult. If you think of enlightenment as somewhere to reach without changing your own attitude and self-grasping misconceptions and misconceptions of self-grasping, then yes, the distance between the point where you start and the enlightenment, the resultant state, can be very, very far away. That's why there are references to the text where it says it takes 3,000 lifetimes to do this or do that, or if you are really a good Buddhist, then maybe in 7 lifetimes. I think the best is the 7 lifetimes. If you recite 1,000,000 of this, then in 15 lifetimes, one will attain enlightenment, and so on and so forth. So those are also very true. Because, you know, between now and the 15th lifetime, there is hope that you will understand this. So if one sees the self entering into a state of enlightenment, then the distance is long. If true nature of the self and the phenomena is understood in a much more pervasive sort of embracing of things as they are, without the agenda of the self, is able to be practiced, then here and now is the enlightened state. There is no adversity. There is no challenge. There is no defeat. There is no suffering. There is no ignorance. There is no badness. There is no negativities. And whenever your mind says, yes, but there is all this suffering out there, then it brings you back again to the same spot that you have seen out there to be very distinct from in here. So, as long as the mind continuously thinks two things, out there and in here, then there is immediately the need to continually work with sort of really eliminating that kind of separation. And the separation and the eliminating of that separation called duality is founded in the investigation of the 12 Nidanas. So, sort of summation of what we have been talking about is Dhamma containing the two aspects, the aspect of reducing of affliction and the increase of the wisdom. The reducing of the afflictions is through the deepening of the understanding of one's own mind brought about by meditation, concentration, such as the four foundations of mindfulness, shamatha, vipassana, meditation. Increase of the wisdom simultaneously must happen, which is then exploring the fundamental true nature of oneself and the others. The recognition of the true nature of self, recognition of the true nature of the other, through the contemplation and exploring the concept of the 12 Nidanas, allows us to better understand nature as is versus what we suppose it to be. And when that is clearly understood, it gives us a much more freer experience of being able to meet with situations as they arise. And that then deepens the meditation on concentration, on mindfulness. Mindfulness challenges us to again bring more truer perspective to the intellectual understandings brought about by contemplation and analytical meditation. And so both of them complement one another very well. So meditation on the four foundations of mindfulness let you have a much more deeper experience of what the intellectual findings of the exploring the teachings of the 12 Nidanas may be. So both of them must work together. The 12 Nidanas to be able to really make more clear the wisdom aspect. Four foundations of mindfulness, shamatha meditation, and vipassana meditation, making sure that the 12 Nidanas and such kinds of analytical approach doesn't retain just a intellectual understanding, doesn't become just a theory, but is able to be felt, because the feeling, the experience of it is the confidence which is absolutely necessary to defeat habitual patterns. But such that the meditation doesn't become a passive state of escape, of escaping, but is actually able to be pristine and pure, then a repeated analysis of what is the nature of mind, what is the nature of this what we assume to be self, what is the nature of phenomena, what we assume to be the other, must be understood. Coming down to the simple question of that leads us to the exploring of the 12 Nidanas is, what is not mind? What is the nature of anything that we think is there, that we perceive to be there, that is not within one's own mind? So, sound, form, taste, smell, texture, all the different kinds of sense consciousnesses and the subtle and the gross mental activities that we experience, ultimately, are they within mind or beyond mind? What do you think? Most oftentimes we think they are beyond mind. That's the birthplace of duality. My mind is my mind. It's inside me, and the rest is out there. So the question here that I leave you with is that true? Is anything possible beyond the horizon, periphery of your own mind? That mind, which is said to be not found and is not solid, not there, not to be sort of seen as a structure. Nevertheless, is there anything that can actually exist, perform, and cease that is not your mind? Eliminate your mind, what remains? If the observer, the mind itself, were not there, how will you be able to posit anything unless you say something as, I will stubbornly believe it to be so? Now, if the stubbornness of saying, yes, it has to be somehow, I don't know how, but it's going to be there. So this is how we sustain the ignorance, is we just leave a very big question mark. That's why I always joke and say, sometimes you all put more trust into examining simple things. With the Americans, of course, it's always water. I always joke about that. So when you come to India, and then how careful you are about water. You know, David McCarthy and I joked about it one time. He got, you know, you are all terrified about water in India. And I think 70% of the time you all fall ill, not because of anything like water or food, but because of fear. Two things. One is the fear, and the second is the side effects of all the shots you take before you come. Apprehension, you know, the sort of the scaredness of, you know, when the mind is so focused upon kind of a concept of falling ill, then, of course, even small things. You sneeze all the time in America, but when you sneeze in India, it's a disaster, isn't it? It's almost like it's a different kind of a sneeze now. So how careful we are in examining even certain drops of water that go into your mouth. Do we place just as much emphasis in analyzing where you place your trust in life, a life that impacts the lives of so many others, and primarily yourself? Fundamentally, what we are talking about here is an absolutely gifted human life that could live in harmony with every encounter, every situation as it evolved. problem that we have, because of which we have to learn how to meditate, learn how to understand the true nature of reality, is not for any other purpose but for the mess that we create when we do not know this truth. So we place our trust in a lot of suppositions of self and the others, discriminating these two to such a degree that we create a tremendous gap between self and whatever this self experiences. And in search of the happiness of the self and the freedom from the suffering of the self, we do not consider the immense amount of causes that we create that bring unnecessary confusion, pain, suffering, chaos in our lives and in the lives of the others. As a Buddhist, the first thing we do as we wake up in the morning is to supplicate to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for basic sanity, that the sanity may enable each one of us to live in harmony among ourselves, within our own selves. We wake up with that awareness, but then that awareness becomes so very, again, drowned in the personal importance. And the personal importance, emphasized and re-emphasized, aggravated, exaggerated, becomes so very big that it doesn't let us see the immense amount of interdependence that we have with one another. That there's hardly any ability to function, not only function, but our own origin itself could never be without the dependency, the sort of codependency between many different factors. So where there is the shared amount of causes and conditions that we have, we are responsible to the others. But no matter how good we are, understanding causality, codependence, no matter how much we try to be aware of, therefore, because we are all dependent upon one another, I'm going to give out only good things. I'm going to really create good causes. No matter how much determined we may be, we will find it impossible to come to a point of such perfection that we create only causes of goodness and do not cause harm to the others. That impossibility, however, can be completely defeated and made possible, the Buddha says, by getting to the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is to then, the root of the problem can be addressed by asking the fundamental question, what is the nature of self, because of which such a very heavy-handed, heavy self-cherishing attitude comes, and the enormous heaviness of the self-cherishing attitude separates everyone else from one's own self, the birth of duality. And therefore, what is it that we trust so much? Is the self? Therefore, what is the nature of self? Just as you examine anything that you place your trust in, here is a trust that you've put in a self-cherishing attitude because of what all the neurosis that we are generating. Then what is the nature of self? What is the nature of self that we assume to be? What is the nature that the self relates to? And so when that is then explored, we find the rhythm that sets us into understanding 12 Nidanas, and fundamentally after that, the true nature of emptiness. Deepen your understanding the Dharma, the correct Dharma, so that the Dharma truly is able, that Dharma that you are relating to is able to truly manifest the two aspects of lessening afflictions and increasing wisdom in one's own self. When that is done, then automatically you're able to bring about immense benefit to yourself and the others. The result does not have to be even thought of. It is just manifest spontaneously when the cause and the path itself is fully engaged as truthfully, as honestly, as purely as possible.